This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of True Fiction by Lee Goldberg, performed by Adam Werner. For Valerie and Maddie, as always. Chapter 1. Honolulu, July 17th, noon, Hawaii Aleutian Standard Time. The assassin wore only a Speedo, and his lean body was slathered with sunscreen that made him smell like a baked coconut. His name was Doric Thane, and he sat on a poolside chaise lounge at Face Waikiki. To his right, and in the distance, was Honolulu International Airport. Behind him, the hotel tower stood against the backdrop of Diamond Head Volcano, and pale kids with floaties around their chubby arms frolicked loudly in the over-chlorinated pool. There was a closed MacBook on his lap, and a cold lava flow cocktail on the table beside him. He scratched absently at the puckered gunshot scar on his stomach and sighed with contentment. Thane opened his MacBook, and a detailed simulation of an airline cockpit control panel filled his screen. The photorealistic animated graphic looked identical to the actual control panel in the cockpit of Trans-American Flight 976, which at that very moment was preparing to depart from Honolulu filled with sunburned tourists in loud aloha shirts and board shorts, heading back to Cleveland. Captain Avery Jenkins went through his pre-flight checklist. He had a touch of gray at his temples that conveyed stability, experience, and wisdom. Those were qualities that every passenger wanted to see in a pilot, and for some stupid reason, the patches of gray bestowed it all upon him. So he'd begun coloring his hair years before the gray came naturally. Jenkins had a new first officer on this flight, Billy Shoup, who was busy plugging coordinates into the flight management system. Shoup was youthful enough to regularly get carded at bars and looked like he had second-degree burns on his face. The captain saw traces of his younger self in Shoup, and it made him a bit wistful. "First layover in Hawaii?" Jenkins asked. Shoup nodded. "How did you know?" "Lucky guess. Let me share a little captainly advice. Next time you're here, don't fall asleep on the beach."
"I didn't. I'm very fair-skinned. I get burned if someone aims a flashlight at me."
"Then we better get you back to Ohio before you burst into flames," Jenkins said. "You're taking us up. Let's get push clearance."
"Yes, sir."
Shoup radioed the tower.
"Honolulu ground. Trans-American 976 requests push clearance off gate 4.
The air traffic controller responded right away, his voice as flat and emotionless as an automated recording. "Trans-America 976, you're cleared to push. Advise when ready to taxi." 5 miles due south, from a chaise lounge at the Diamond Head Tradewinds Resort, the assassin studied the live readings on the airplane control console on his MacBook screen. Trans-American Flight 976 was leaving the gate. Doric Thane smiled. The fun was about to begin. Trans-American Flight 976 taxied on the runway, and First Officer Shoup dutifully waited for the go-ahead from the tower. "You are cleared for immediate liftoff on runway 8R, the controller said by rote. "On departure, fly heading 140. The runway was on a reef that pointed at the resorts along Waikiki, so the controllers always ordered departing planes, no matter where they were bound, to immediately head south to avoid buzzing the beach and destroying the tropical tranquility for the tourists.
"Roger. Trans-American 976 cleared for takeoff on runway 8R, heading 140,
Shoup confirmed, then looked to the captain for the official confirmation.
"You have the aircraft," Jenkins said.
"I have the aircraft."
Shoup sat up straight in his seat, confident and eager, and pushed the thrust levers forward and activated the auto throttle. The plane raced down the runway, picking up speed. Shoup pulled back the side stick, and the plane began climbing into the sky at 2,000 feet per minute, toward Diamond Head in the distance, where Doric Thane sat on his chaise lounge, his fingers poised over the keyboard of the MacBook on his lap. The assassin tapped a few keys, initiating the autopilot on his cockpit console, stopping the climb and changing the flight's heading to 090. He was in control of the flight. The cockpit crew was as powerless as the passengers now. They might as well order a drink, eat some peanuts, and enjoy the ride. Captain Jenkins instantly noticed that the plane was flying parallel to Honolulu on their left, rather than veering to their right toward the open sea. But that wasn't all that was wrong. The altimeter showed them leveling off at 1,200 feet, when they should have been climbing. "What are you doing?" Jenkins asked Shoup. "The heading is 140.
"I know that," Shoup said, struggling with his side stick. "But the stick isn't responding."
The reason why was obvious. The captain saw that the green autopilot light was lit up on the instrument panel, indicating that the system had been activated. He sighed with irritation at the kid's carelessness.
"That's because you accidentally engaged the autopilot."
Chagrined, Shoup pressed the autopilot button on his side stick to disengage the system. But the light stayed on. He shot the captain a frightened look.
"It won't turn off."
"Transamerica 976, turn immediately to 140.
The controller yelled into his ear, some life in his voice now.
"You have leveled off. I repeat, turn to 140.
Jenkins grasped his side stick and hit the disconnect button, but the autopilot didn't disengage, and his side stick wouldn't respond either. He didn't make any sense. He felt his heart drop into his stomach like a sandbag. Thane saw the plane in the distance, heading his way like an obedient dog returning to its master. He typed in a new heading, 010°. The captain and the first officer were both pulling hard on their side sticks, desperate to get a response, when the aircraft inexplicably turned east toward the high-rise hotels of Waikiki and began a fast, steady descent. The action meant more to Jenkins than an unexpected and terrifying navigational change. It was the cold touch of an unseen hand.
"Tell the tower we have an emergency," Jenkins ordered Shoup
and continued to hit the autopilot button while he wrestled with the side stick.
"I have the aircraft."
The captain wasn't saying he had regained control. He was stating that he was now the only one attempting to fly the plane. This acknowledgement prevented two people from trying to fly the plane at the same time. But that was exactly what was happening.
"Mayday! Mayday! Transamerican 976 is declaring an emergency," Shoup said, his voice cracking. "We are not in control of the aircraft."
"But someone is," Jenkins said.
Shoup looked at him, baffled.
"What do you mean?"
"We leveled off before the turn. That's a decision, not a computer glitch."
The captain was right about that. The plane was heading straight for Waikiki. Thane could see it from where he was sitting. So could the tourists on chaise lounges around him. The tourists were getting to their feet, staring at the sky. Even the kids in the pools were beginning to realize something was very wrong. All eyes were fixed on the plane. Nobody noticed what was on the assassin's MacBook screen. He tapped the up arrow on his keyboard, increasing the plane's airspeed to 350 knots. Now the people on Waikiki Beach could see and hear the plane coming in fast and low, only 100 feet off the ground. Thousands of people on the sand scrambled in sheer terror, with no idea where to go. Thane saw the mass panic from afar. It reminded him of when he was a kid and liked to drop lit matches into anthills. In the airplane's cockpit, Shoup was frozen by the sight of the rapidly approaching Honolulu skyline in front of him. But for Captain Jenkins, time slowed down and his mind cleared, even as the frantic air traffic controller was screaming, pull up in his ear, and the altitude alarm wailed. He was focused on the problem. The autopilot had control of the plane. Someone had control of the autopilot. How could he stop it? The answer was so simple. Kill the technology. Jenkins hit a slew of buttons, shutting down all of the plane's computer systems. The system reverted to manual control, and then he was flying an old-fashioned stick-and-rudder airplane. He felt the side stick come alive in his hand like a startled, pissed-off animal. "I have the plane!" he yelled. Jenkins pulled back the stick, lifting the plane into a steep climb. But he didn't see any blue sky in front of him. All he saw was the 20th floor of the Hyatt Regency. It was too late. The fuselage plowed right through the center of the hotel in an enormous fireball, and the aircraft's wings were sheared off by the adjoining buildings. A chain reaction of explosions erupted as the flaming wreckage and toppled buildings spread the destruction inland. A massive, roiling cloud of fire, glass, and rubble sprawled out in all directions, covering the beach and sending people rushing into the water in a futile effort to escape the devastation. The ground beneath Doric Thane shook, as if the long-dead Diamond Head volcano were about to blow. Panic broke out among the people around him, which he thought was stupid, since they were obviously a safe distance from the crash and the death cloud. Instead, they should have been celebrating their good luck. The assassin closed his MacBook, tucked it under one arm, and got to his feet, observed by no one amid all the senseless screaming and crying. He picked up his cocktail and was pleased to discover that it hadn't lost its chill. He walked casually away, his back to the terrified tourists and the carnage, and sipped his lava flow. It was cold and sweet. This was how to kill people. Chapter 2. Seattle, Washington, July 17th, 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. The impeccably tailored Tom Ford tuxedo fit Clint Straker's muscular 6-foot frame like a second skin, and showed no sign of the two knives and the garrote sewn into the lining. He was one of the 200 guests at a garden party on the back lawn of international shipping magnate Martin Hung's massive lakefront estate. They were all there to honor Hung on his 55th birthday. Straker was there to make sure Hung didn't celebrate his 56th. Hung may be the leader of the world's largest sex slavery ring, but you have to admire his beautiful home and its feng shui, said Kenny Wu, Straker's local contact and the man who'd secured him an invitation to the party. Wu's tuxedo was one size too big for his bony body and made him look like a ridiculously overdressed scarecrow. See how the house is tucked into the hillside and faces the water? That creates an unobstructed path for the chi. Straker's gaze was on a beautiful Asian woman in a white dress so sheer that she might as well have been wearing nothing at all. Chi? The positive life force. Good to know, Straker said and picked up two full champagne glasses from a passing waiter. Be seeing you, Wu. Where are you going? Straker tipped his head toward the woman. To create an unobstructed path for my chi. Ian Ludlow finished reading aloud from his book and smiled, pleased with the last line and with himself for being clever enough to write it. He stood at a wobbly lectern beside a table covered with hardcover copies of his latest Clint Straker thriller, The Dead Never Forget, and paperback copies of the previous 6 titles in his New York Times best-selling series. His book covers all featured the silhouette of his gun-toting action hero, set against a backdrop of explosions, international landmarks, sports cars, and beautiful women with enormous boobs. He was in Seattle, the first stop in a 6-city, 10-day publicity tour for his new book. Today, he was speaking at a boho chic bookstore, where everybody reeked of weed, and only 8 people showed up for his signing. Ian didn't care about the low turnout. He was on a paid vacation. I think that excerpt sums up the essence of Clint Straker, and what makes him so attractive to men and women alike, Ian told his audience, who sat scattered among the 4 rows of chairs in front of him. Any questions? A young guy in a faded University of Washington sweatshirt spoke up. How much do you share in common with Clint Straker? Isn't it obvious? Ian asked the audience. Look at me. They did. What they saw was a guy on the dark side of 30 with the soft body of someone whose idea of exercise was walking into McDonald's rather than using the drive-thru. His right arm was in a blue cast and locked at a 90-degree angle, but it wasn't wearing a sling. Instead, he just hooked his right thumb in the gap above one of the closed buttons of his untucked dress shirt to support the weight of his broken arm. He wore fashionably faded jeans and white Nikes. By contrast, Clint Straker was physically perfect, a 6-foot-tall Special Forces vet who looked great wearing anything and could be mistaken for the model for Michelangelo's David when he wore nothing at all. He was a spy for hire, a deductive genius and an unstoppable killing machine who didn't salute any flag or fight for any political or religious ideology except his own personal moral code. Clint Straker can beat up 3 ninjas using only a napkin as a weapon, Ian said. But I've never hit anybody in my life, and I'm a complete klutz. A few weeks ago, I accidentally blew up my house. Which was a big reason why he was glad to be on a book tour. He was going to be living out of a suitcase for a while, and he much preferred to do it at his publisher's expense rather than his own. While he was on tour, they paid for his accommodations and his meals, too. It was a sweet deal, and the timing was perfect. He wondered if there was a way to extend the tour another week or two. So, where did Clint come from? The young man asked. Out of misery and desperation. I was in my 3rd year as a writer on the TV series Hollywood and the Vine. The words were barely out of his mouth when someone interrupted and intoned in a deep announcer's voice, "Half man, half plant, all cop." Some people laughed, and then it seemed like everybody in the store started singing the show's theme song, which was basically the chorus of Marvin Gaye's I Heard It Through the Grapevine, with very different lyrics. Ooh, you heard about that cop, Vine? A plant who can't stand crime. You get caught, you're gonna do time. Honey, honey, yeah. Ian smiled good-naturedly and looked at the back of the room to see how this newfound attention was playing with Vince, the scraggly bearded store manager, and Margot, the 20-something author escort with short-cropped, deep black hair, who'd been hired by his publisher to drive him around Seattle. Vince looked as if he'd been startled out of a nap, but Margot was busy texting, seemingly oblivious to what was going on. It was suddenly important to Ian that he win Margot's attention. She was bone-thin and braless in a retro tie-dyed t-shirt, torn jeans and flip-flops. She wasn't his type at all. Not that he'd turn her down if she threw herself at him, but she was a barometer of sorts. She was being paid to show an interest in him, and if she was bored, it didn't say much for how his performance was going over with the people who weren't getting paid to be there. Ian went on with his story, which he'd told 1,000 times before. It usually got him big laughs and lots of sympathy. I was riding for a shrub with a badge. It was soul-crushing. So I escaped into the action-packed world of Clint Straker, and before I knew it, I had a novel. I sold the book, left the show, and my publishing career took off. Book money wasn't quite as good as TV money, but he was a single guy without much overhead, especially now that his house was in ashes and he liked being in control of his own creative life. He didn't have to write anything he didn't want to anymore, and that was worth a slight drop in his income. The only things he didn't like about being an author instead of a TV writer were writing alone and buying his own lunch. A frizzy-haired woman in the audience, dressed in a halter top that looked like it was hand-woven out of hemp, raised her hand.
How did you break your arm?
I wish I could say that I did it doing something heroic, like grabbing a suicidal woman just as she leaped off a freeway overpass and holding on to her until the fire department showed up, Ian said. But the truth is that I fell off my bike. That's what I get for removing the training wheels. He could tell from the expression on the woman's face that she wasn't amused. In fact, she seemed disappointed in him.
You really aren't Clint Straker, she said.
Nobody is. Margot looked up at his remark, and she seemed to like it. That pleased him until he realized how pathetic it was that he wanted her attention or her approval. He figured it only proved that no matter how successful he was, and he was by just about any measure, he would always be just another insecure writer. Ian signed books for the 8 customers and left the bookstore with Margot 5 minutes later. Ordinarily, he would have stayed to autograph every book, on the off chance someone might buy a copy later. But he was right-handed, and it wasn't easy signing with his arm in a cast, and the manager didn't ask him to, which wasn't very encouraging. Margot drove Ian back to his downtown hotel in a rented Impala that felt ridiculously huge for only the two of them. It also seemed like the wrong car for her. She struck him as a VW Beetle kind of woman. Or maybe a Mini Cooper if she had some money, which she obviously didn't. Or the publisher would have reimbursed her gas and miles to drive him around Seattle, rather than step up for a rental car. Maybe she didn't even own a car. That was disappointing, Ian said. I usually draw a bigger crowd.
It wasn't your fault, Margot said. Union Bay is more of a literary bookstore.
My books aren't literary.
They're spy novels, she said.
That doesn't mean they aren't literary fiction. Somerset Maugham, Joseph Conrad, John le Carré, and Graham Greene all wrote spy novels.
In your last book, Clint Straker seduced a female enemy agent and gave her an orgasm so intense that she fell into a coma for 3 days.
He felt it was a more humane way of sidelining her than assassination, Ian said. I think that shows his literary depth of character.
It certainly does, she said.
He wasn't sure how to take that, but he was pleased that she'd read the book and remembered the sex scene. And then he felt foolish that he felt that way. Something about her had turned him into an awkward teenager. It was probably because he hadn't been laid in ages, and being around any woman made him stupidly eager to create a positive impression.
Margot pulled up to the entrance of the Sheraton Hotel at the corner of 6th Avenue and Pike Street and parked the car outside the door. I'll meet you here at 10 a.m. tomorrow for your signing at the Crime of Your Life bookstore, she said. Do you want to keep the car for the rest of the day?
No, you take it. I think I'll stay in and write, maybe enjoy the room service. Unless you'd like to join me.
Margot gave him a hard look. I'm not that kind of escort.
Ian felt his face flush with embarrassment. I wasn't implying that we'd be in my room. What I meant was that I'd eat with you somewhere that's not in my room if you wanted to eat too.
She smiled, amused by his discomfort. I was joking. I appreciate the invite, but I've got dogs to walk and they're probably ready to burst.
We wouldn't want that, Ian said, reaching across himself with his left hand to open his door. Thanks for taking me around today. See you tomorrow.
He slid out of the seat, closed the door with his hip, and watched her drive off.
Was it really an innocent misunderstanding, or was he suggesting she come up to his room? He wasn't entirely sure. Maybe his desperation was coming through. With that in mind, he walked into the lobby and headed straight for the bar to see if there were any women around who'd jump at the chance to sleep with a New York Times best-selling author. But as he neared the bar, he could feel tension in the air like an electrical charge. Dozens of people were standing and staring at the wall-mounted TVs, all of which were tuned to CNN. The screens were filled with apocalyptic images of destruction in Waikiki,
and scores of injured people on the beach.
Ian stopped just outside the bar and caught a portion of Anchorman Wolf Blitzer's report.
Blitzer: thousands are hurt, hundreds are feared dead. Nobody knows at this point if the crash of Trans-American 976 was the result of mechanical failure, human error, or an intentional act. But the parallels to 9/11 are impossible to ignore and deeply disturbing.
Ian shook his head and backed away from the bar, gripped by the crazy fear that someone might whirl around, recognize him, and shriek at the top of their lungs, "You're responsible for this!"
Chapter 3. Capitol Hill, Washington, D.C. July 17th, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The hearing in the Senate chamber wasn't on any official schedule, and began while Trans-American 976 was boarding. There were no observers or reporters present. There wasn't even a stenographer. There were only the seven senators of the Intelligence Committee at the rostrum, and the one man sitting at the witness table in front of them. The man's name was Wilton Cross. His bushy mustache, round cheeks, and double chin made him look lovable, like he'd be more comfortable as a department store Santa, or reading Dr. Seuss to his adorable grandchildren, than sitting in a bespoke $6,000 Italian suit, briefing politicians.
"For 30 years, I managed the CIA's covert operations on a day-to-day basis," Cross said. "In other words, I oversaw all of our surveillance, theft, sabotage, blackmail, smuggling, abduction, and killing."
The committee chairman, the corpulent, one-time failed presidential nominee, Senator Ramsey Holbrooke, harumphed with disapproval.
"I wouldn't characterize our intelligence efforts that way."
"That's one reason why the government shouldn't be doing this kind of work, Mr. Chairman," Cross said. "You can't do something well if you're in denial about what you're doing. Add to that the bureaucracy, the limited budgets, the dated technology, and the fear of prosecution, and what do you get? 50 years of catastrophic intelligence failures. Meanwhile, the private sector, freed of those constraints, excels at the same work."
"Theft? Extortion, kidnapping, murder?"
said Senator Sam Tolan, a colorful Texas lawyer who enjoyed Stetson hats, Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders, and fat cigars, preferably all at once.
"That's right," Cross said.
Holbrooke harumphed again and browsed through the thick binder of material from Cross that each senator had in front of him.
"What you're proposing, Mr. Cross, is that we outsource our covert operations to you, Blackthorn Global Security. That's an audacious proposal, to say the least."
"But not unprecedented or unproven," Cross said. "We've had a long and successful outsourcing relationship with the Pentagon, fighting in places the military isn't authorized to be, or engaging in activities they are prohibited from doing."
Senator Bradley Hazleton, a fifth-generation politician from North Carolina, nodded. He'd emerged unscathed from three separate Justice Department corruption probes during his three terms in office, despite his guilt.
"I must admit that those of us in intelligence oversight have been envious of the flexibility enjoyed by our colleagues on the Armed Services Committee."
Envy was good. Cross could work with that. He continued his presentation, shifting his gaze from one senator to another as he spoke.
"Over the last decade, the nature of the threat to America has radically changed. It's about terrorism now. Terrorists are swifter, more agile, and deadlier than armies. Borders are meaningless. Laws, ethics, morality, and accountability don't exist. We aren't on the same battlefield. We need to be, or we're finished. Blackthorn will bring the war to them, only with greater technology and precision than our enemies.
But with the same total disregard for legality, morality, and responsibility."
That remark came from Kelly Stowe, the California senator with the perfect tan and capped teeth, who turned to politics after his acting career fizzled out. Stowe took a lot of flack for frequently saying "dude" in his speeches from the Senate floor.
Of course not, Senator, Cross said. We'll go much further than that.
Stowe stared at him.
You can't be serious.
Blackthorn will do whatever is necessary to protect our democracy.
What you're describing is the antithesis of democracy, Stowe said.
Not if you wanted to survive, Cross said. The room filled with a loud buzzing, as if a swarm of killer bees had suddenly invaded the chamber. It was the sound of every senator's smartphone vibrating at once. A mass alert couldn't be good news. The senators all reached for their devices and looked apprehensively at their screens. The color couldn't have drained faster from Senator Holbrook's face if his throat had been slit. That was a fact, by the way, that Wilton Cross knew from personal experience.
Oh my God, Holbrook said, rising with difficulty from his seat due to the emotional strain and his enormous weight. We have an emergency. We need to adjourn and reconvene at another time.
Of course, Cross said. The senators quickly filed out through the door behind the rostrum without bothering to give Cross any details about the emergency. He didn't mind the slight. Cross was a spymaster. It was his job to already know what others knew, and he did this time, too. He knew before it even happened. Chapter 4 Blackthorn Global Security Headquarters, Bethesda, Maryland. July 17th, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. A floor-to-ceiling screen dominated the two-story, curved front wall in Blackthorn's Situation Room. The media wall showed a collage of feeds from all of the U.S. television news broadcasts and video, both live and recorded, collected from a multitude of surveillance cameras in Waikiki, as well as photos and videos of the plane crash and its catastrophic aftermath, captured from social media sites. The screen depicted so much activity, drama and emotion, that it radiated a frenetic, psychic energy that was contagious, jacking up the anxiety level of every Blackthorn operative in the room. There were 24 workstations angled toward the media wall. The workstations were dominated by large, ultra-thin touchscreens where the Blackthorn operatives manipulated data and video windows like mahjong tiles that could be sent to a colleague's screen or thrown up onto the media wall with a finger swipe. Wilton Cross stood at the command console in the back of the room and watched the data gathering that his people were doing. He hit a button on his touchscreen, and Fox News anchor Shepard Smith took the center position on the media wall. Smith, the president has been briefed and is monitoring the situation. A White House spokesman says at this point there is no evidence to suggest that this is a terrorist act.
There isn't?
Cross posed the question to the room and hit a button on the console, muting the newscast.
Tell me what intel authorities have so far.
The first person to respond was Victoria Takahara, the analyst who sat to his left. She was a Pentagon hire who had spent most of her 10-year military career at a keyboard, directing drone strikes against terrorists. She'd killed more people from the comfort of a Herman Miller chair, with a Starbucks cinnamon dolce latte in one hand, than most soldiers ever did on a battlefield. But Cross knew from reading the intelligence reports on her that in her private life she liked a more visceral experience, one that would make Christian Grey or the Marquis de Sade cower. The NTSB, FBI, Pentagon, and CIA have radar and satellite data that shows the plane prematurely leveled off after departure and turned east, Victoria said. They also have audio of the pilot reporting an emergency and that they'd lost control of the aircraft.
There's more.
This time it was Seth Barkley who spoke. The former CIA analyst sat at Cross's right. His psychiatric profile described him as a highly functioning nonviolent sociopath, afflicted with a hint of Asperger syndrome. He was 30 years old and his most intimate physical relationship to date was with his touchscreen.
The authorities have the system data stream that's automatically transmitted by the plane to the airline and the engine manufacturer. The data indicates that the plane's autopilot was engaged and there were no mechanical malfunctions.
How could the pilots have lost control if the autopilot was on and there were no malfunctions? Cross said. Who is asking those questions?
Probably everybody involved in the investigation, Seth said.
Cross pointed to the news broadcasts streaming on the media wall.
I mean out there.
No one yet, Seth said. The media doesn't have the data.
Change that. Leak the information we have to some of the aviation pundits under contract to the TV networks, Cross said. Encourage them to start speculating on the worst possible scenarios.
They won't need the encouragement, Victoria said. Fear is what keeps them on the air and getting paid.
What about background on the passengers and crew? Cross asked. Any red flags that we can exploit? Like felony criminal records, terrorist ties, or diagnosed mental instability?
None so far, Victoria said. But I doubt it was a flight full of angels.
If they weren't before, Seth said, they are now.
I'm sure there are a few who are on a spit and getting stabbed with a pitchfork, Victoria said.
Cross knew that she might as well be describing her idea of casual foreplay.
I want updates every 15 minutes.
Yes, sir, she said.
Cross walked out of the Situation Room and headed down the hallway, past several conference rooms to his large corner office, which had an adjoining private apartment as luxuriously appointed as a suite at the Four Seasons. It sure beat the vinyl-upholstered couch and mini-fridge that he'd had in his cramped basement office at the CIA. He'd spent many nights on that damn couch. Now, when work demanded that he spend a night in the office, he enjoyed a king-size bed fitted with sumptuous 1,020-thread count sheets of Egyptian cotton, gossamer woven in Italy by naked Nubal virgins. The part about the Nubal virgins was just a guess on his part, but the thought of it often eased him into a peaceful sleep with a languid hard-on.
Chapter 5. Sheraton Hotel, Seattle, Washington, July 18th, 3:47 a.m. Pacific Standard Time.
The only light in Ian Ludlow's dark hotel room came from the open, ravaged minibar and the flickering glow from the TV which had been playing CNN all night. Jake Tapper was on the air now, giving an update against a backdrop of photos of the devastation in Honolulu. It looked like nuclear winter had come to paradise. A ticker tape crawl at the bottom of the screen kept a gruesome tally of the victims, like the score of a football game. 238 people were dead, 117 injured, but both numbers were expected to rise. Tapper. At the same moment air traffic controllers noticed that the plane had changed its heading and leveled off, the pilots radioed the tower that they'd lost control of the aircraft. With me now is Sean Danielson, a former NTSB investigator and our senior aviation editor. Sean, what does that tell you? Danielson was a talking head in his 50s with dark circles under his hangdog eyes. He was wearing a wrinkled Lacoste polo shirt that looked as if it might have been yanked out of the hamper. He joined Tapper on Skype from what appeared to be his kitchen table. Danielson's backdrop was a toaster oven and microwave on a granite countertop.
Danielson, a horrifying story, Jake. All departing aircraft leaving Honolulu International immediately turn away from Waikiki toward the open sea to avoid flying low over the beaches. But 976 didn't do that. The plane leveled off at 1,200 feet, then veered toward the beach in a fast, steady descent. In fact, I've learned from sources close to the investigation that data transmitted during takeoff indicates that the autopilot was engaged.
Tapper, are you saying that the crash was deliberate?
Danielson, there is no other explanation.
Ian was lying fully dressed on top of a bed, his back propped up with pillows, staring at the TV. Empty mini bottles from the minibar were scattered on the bed, along with candy bar wrappers and crinkled empty bags of chips. He chewed on the last bite of his last Toblerone and wondered for perhaps the 100th time if he was having a waking nightmare, or if this was really happening.
Maybe it was all just a horrible coincidence. Maybe he had nothing to do with it. Then again, maybe he did. Maybe it all began 3 years ago with a group of writers gathered in a mountain cabin, making up stories. He hadn't seen the harm in it. It was all make-believe. A story never killed anyone. Until now. Chapter 6. Somewhere in Maine, 3 years ago, winter.
"What about a plane crash?" Ian said.
The six men were gathered in a remote log cabin in the middle of a snowy forest. The interior was almost entirely decorated in animal hides and wood. The sofa and armchairs were upholstered in leather, the rugs were cowhide, and the tables were rough-hewn antique walnut. A roaring fire crackled in a big fieldstone hearth, and a pair of moose antlers was mounted over the log mantel. Ian half expected Daniel Boone to bound in, shake the snow off his bearskin jacket, and toss his coonskin cap on one of those antlers. Ian sat in an armchair that was as close to the fire as he could get without setting his cable-knit wool sweater aflame. He was from Southern California, so his idea of a freezing temperature was anything below 60 degrees, and it was a good 30 degrees below that outside. Just looking at the frosty windows made him shiver.
"A plane crash has been done," said Clayton Roper, a heavyset man in his 60s who sat in the armchair beside Ian and sucked on his pipe like it was his only source of oxygen. 9/11, the shoe bomber, that suicidal pilot who flew into a mountain. It's become a cliche. I thought we're supposed to be using our imaginations. How about smallpox?"
"What about it?" asked Kurt Delmore, a screenwriter who sat on one end of the sofa, absently stroking his graying hipster goatee. He was a 40-year-old man with the beginnings of a beer belly under his vintage bowling shirt.
"It's a virus that has killed millions over the centuries. Nobody is vaccinated against smallpox anymore because everybody thinks it has been eradicated, but in reality it hasn't been," Clayton said. "There are vials of the stuff out there, weaponized and jacked up with Ebola, another nightmarish shit. What if terrorists get hold of a vial? What if they get vaccinated, then go to the Super Bowl and use pocket atomizers, disguised as breath fresheners or inhalers for people with asthma, and spritz the virus into the crowd? Thousands of people would be infected in seconds without even knowing it. In 10 days, an epidemic could spread across the nation, if not the world, creating a global pandemic that could wipe out 3/4 of humanity."
"That sounds like one of your Death Fist novels to me," Kurt said.
"It is," Clayton said. "That's how I know the plot works."
"We aren't here to reuse our old plots, but to think up new ones," Kurt said. "Here's a fun fact. Los Angeles uses an underground cavern to store enough natural gas to heat the city for a year. The cavern is located beneath thousands of homes. What if terrorists ignited the gas? The massive explosion would make the big one seem like a fart."
"I'm not sure your science is right," said Jose Contreras from where he sat at the kitchen table, hunched over a sketch pad, smoking a joint, and drawing a picture of a runaway train going off the rails in a fiery blast. He was the youngest man in the room by at least a decade, and was a renowned author and illustrator of graphic novels.
"Maybe the gas wouldn't explode, and instead, you'd create a geyser of fire that couldn't be put out." "That's cool," Kurt said.
"Yeah, but it wouldn't be a catastrophe," Jose said.
"It might become a tourist attraction instead. But I know for a fact that a runaway train full of crude oil derailed in Canada, and the inferno decimated an entire town. We could work with that."
He held up a sketch for everyone to see. It looked to Ian like a freeze frame from an action movie sequence, as if all it would take was someone hitting play on a remote for the catastrophe to unfold on the page. Jose had talent, but Ian wasn't wild about the derailed train idea.
"Getting back to the plane crash," Ian said. "I understand your objections, Clayton, but I'm not talking about a hijacking or a bomb. I'm talking about using planes as guided missiles."
Forgetting for a moment how boring and familiar that is, Clayton said. There's intense levels of security now at airports and in planes, strictly to prevent that scenario from happening. You know why? Because what you're talking about has already been done. Move on. But Ian wasn't giving up yet.
What if I could crash a plane into downtown San Francisco, or the Las Vegas Strip, or any place I want, any time I want, without setting foot in the airport or on the aircraft?
Are you just throwing the notion out there for discussion?
That question came from Bob, the man who'd brought them all here. It was the first time he'd spoken in 2 hours. Bob sat on the couch on the opposite corner from Kurt. There was something grandfatherly and comforting about Bob, unlike the stony-faced man who stood at the wall near the front door, his arms crossed under his chest, wearing an earpiece that kept him in contact with the other stony-faced men who were somewhere outside in the snow.
"Or do you have a way to do it?" Bob added.
"I think I do," Ian said. "You'll have to find out if it's actually possible, but isn't that why the CIA invited us out here?"
Bob smiled.
"Tell us your evil plan."
Chapter 7. Sheraton Hotel, Seattle, Washington. July 18th, 3:48 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Ian reached for his iPhone on his nightstand and called Clayton Roper, who lived on Cape Cod, where he'd churned out a book a month in his Death Fist series for decades. The books were about Michael Tsang, an ex-priest turned assassin and restaurateur who was an expert in all of the martial, exotic, and culinary arts. It was one of the last surviving series in the men's action-adventure genre that once included heroes like the Executioner, the Penetrator, the Destroyer, the SOBs, Black Samurai, and Mr. Jury. The phone was answered by a young woman on the second ring.
"Hello, this is Emily."
Ian sat up straighter in bed and tried to quash his anxiety from creeping into his voice.
"Good morning, Emily. My name is Ian Ludlow. I'm sorry to be calling so early, but I have to speak to Clayton."
"That's not going to happen."
"It's urgent. I'm sure that he won't mind if you wake him up for this."
"I wish I could," Emily said. "But I don't have the power to raise the dead." Her last word hit Ian like a bucket of ice water poured over his head. He was stunned, and yet completely alert.
"Did you say dead?"
"My father died 6 weeks ago," she said, a weariness creeping into her voice.
"So you can forget about whatever he owes you."
"I'm not after any money. I was a friend of his. I'm a writer, too. I write the Clint Straker novels."
"Forgive me. I don't read much, and I didn't mean to be rude. I'm his only child, and ever since he died, I've been getting calls from bill collectors. I had no idea he was having any financial trouble, so that's been a shock, too. Dad never talked to me about that kind of thing."
"It's okay. I totally understand. I can only imagine how overwhelming it must be for you to have to deal with all of this," Ian said.
"If you don't mind, may I ask how he died?"
"He was out fishing, and his boat capsized. He drowned." For a moment, Ian couldn't summon the air to breathe, much less speak. The implications of what she said were too horrifying to consider, and they put recent events in his own life in a whole new light.
"Were you too close?" Emily asked.
"No, not really," Ian replied almost in a whisper. He cleared his throat and regained his voice.
"We met at a writers' conference a few years ago. He had a vivid imagination.
It sustained him, financially and in just about every other way. But I guess that's true of most writers. He was always emotionally distant. Sometimes it felt like he was saving his emotional investments for the characters in his books. He definitely cared more about Michael Tsang, the Death Fist, than he did any of his wives," Emily said.
"Forgive me, again I'm rambling. What was the urgent matter you needed to discuss with him?"
"It's irrelevant now," Ian said. "I'm sorry for your loss." Ian ended the call, tossed the phone on the bed, then reached down with his good arm to pick up his MacBook from the floor. He set the computer on his lap, raised the screen to wake it from its snooze, and typed Kurt Delmore with his left hand into the search window of his browser. In an instant, the Google search results came up on his screen, arranged by date. The most recent mention was an article from Deadline Hollywood, the entertainment industry news site. It was Kurt Delmore's obituary. Chapter 8. Blackthorn Global Security Headquarters, Bethesda, Maryland. July 18th, 7:10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Victoria Takahara was at her touchscreen, scrolling through the petty criminal record of a Trans-American 976 passenger, when she heard an alert beep from her computer. A telephone icon blinked on her screen. She tapped it. A graphic of an audio recording that resembled an EKG readout popped up with two phone numbers listed underneath it. One number was Ian Ludlow's iPhone. The other was Clayton Roper's home phone in Cape Cod. Both devices were constantly monitored by Blackthorn, and all calls, sent or received, were automatically recorded, flagged, and archived. The timestamp showed that the call had occurred only moments ago. She touched the app's play button and listened. Emily. Hello, this is Emily. Ian. Good morning, Emily. My name is Ian Ludlow. I'm sorry to be calling so early, but I have to speak to Clayton. Emily, that's not going to happen. Ian, it's urgent. Victoria swore to herself, tapped the screen to pause the recording, and then typed a command on her keyboard. An instant later, Ian Ludlow's worried face appeared in a window on her screen, as if they were having a live FaceTime video chat. In a sense, they were, only it was one way. He didn't know that his camera was on. The green light on the top edge of his screen that would ordinarily have lit up when his camera was on had been deactivated by Victoria's hacking program, the instant she'd hijacked his MacBook to spy on him. His microphone was live, too, recording the sound of his anxious breathing. The hacking program was also recording his keystrokes, capturing his passwords and anything else he wrote. She tapped on Ian's face with her cursor, and a new window opened in front of her, showing her exactly what he was looking at on his MacBook screen. He pulled up the month-old Deadline Hollywood obituary for Kurt Delmore, a screenwriter of low-budget action movies who died of a heart attack in his sleep. She looked at Ian. His face betrayed his shock and increasing horror at what he was learning from the information on screen. This wasn't good for either of them. Victoria picked up her phone and called Cross at his office. He answered immediately, awake and alert.
Cross?
Sir, we have a problem developing.
What is it?
Ian Ludlow called Clayton Roper. Now he's checking out the others. He hung up without a word. She set the phone down in its cradle, and a moment later, Cross marched into the situation room.
Show me, he said.
Victoria swiped both of the windows up on her touchscreen, and they disappeared from her monitor and appeared in the center of the media wall as if they'd flown there from her desk. Now everyone in the situation room could see that Ian Ludlow was Googling another name, Jose Contreras.
He's connecting the dots, Cross said.
Several search results came up on Ian's MacBook. The top one was a Los Angeles Times article from a few weeks ago, reporting on the graphic artist's tragic death from a drug overdose. Ian Ludlow is the luckiest man on earth, Cross thought. They'd made two attempts to kill him already, both designed to look like accidents, but he'd survived. Cross decided at the time that making a third within weeks of the other two might appear suspicious to local authorities and might prompt an investigation. Now he wished he'd taken the gamble. Everyone in the situation room watched as Ian pulled up the Los Angeles Times article and scrolled through it, stopping at the paragraph that described Jose as a recovering drug addict, and expressed his family's shock that he'd fallen prey to demons that they thought he'd conquered years ago. Ian looked at the cast on his right arm. Cross saw the dawning realization and the accompanying horror in the naked, completely unguarded expression on Ian's face. The writer knew he was a dead man. He slammed the laptop closed, and both of the surveillance windows on the media wall went dark. Cross turned to Seth.
Where is Ludlow now?
He's in Seattle at the Sheraton Hotel on 6th and Pike, room 3016. He's on a book tour for his new novel.
Seth swiped up onto the media wall a screen grab of Ian's book tour itinerary from his publisher's website.
He's signing at the Crime of Your Life bookstore at 10:30 this morning, and then he goes to Denver this afternoon.
Cross turned to Victoria.
Where's our nearest asset?
Waiting for him in Denver, Victoria said. She can be in Seattle in 3 hours.
That's not soon enough, Cross said,
then raised his voice so everyone in the Situation Room could hear him.
Listen up. This is a Priority One alert. I want eyes and ears on Ludlow at all times. Full Big Brother, starting now. We need to take this player off the board.
Ian sat on his hotel room toilet, his pants bunched up around his feet, crapping his guts out in sheer terror. He'd felt his sphincters open up the instant he'd closed his laptop and had barely made it to the bathroom in time. He'd dreamed up a terrorist plot to kill hundreds of people as a hypothetical scenario for the CIA so they could prevent it from ever happening. Instead, the CIA used his idea to attack their own country for some twisted reason he couldn't imagine. Or maybe he could, given enough time. He was a writer, and imagining was his job. But time was something he didn't have, because the CIA was out to kill him. Hell, maybe he deserved to die. Hundreds of people were dead in Hawaii. He didn't crash that plane himself, but it was his fucking idea. He was the author of all that destruction. He felt his bowels blow again, but he was empty inside. Instead, his purged intestines tangled themselves up in knots of fear that made him curl up with pain. He hugged himself and rocked on the toilet. It was little comfort. How was he going to survive? And how would he live with himself if he did? Chapter 9. Sheraton Hotel, Seattle, Washington. July 18th, 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Ian peeked out from behind a pillar outside the Sheraton's lobby and saw Margot walking from the street toward the automatic doors. She wore a black tank top, pre-torn jeans, and ankle boots. He stepped out of hiding just as she passed.
Margot, over here!
She jerked, startled, her hand reflexively going to her chest. He wondered why people, particularly women, touched their chests when they were surprised. He made a mental note to ask an expert in human nature to explain it to him. It would make a cool fact for his next book, assuming he lived long enough to write another one.
Sorry, he said. I didn't mean to scare you.
Margot cocked her head and studied him. He had his leather messenger bag over his right shoulder, and his Samsonite rolling carry-on suitcase at his left side. He was wearing the same wrinkled clothes from the previous day. His cast was spattered with melted chocolate, and he was looking around furtively with bloodshot eyes.
"Were you hiding?" she asked.
Yes, and it was stupid, because he knew it was no secret that he was in Seattle, or even that he was staying at the Sheraton. He'd sent a tweet to his 5,788 followers when he'd landed, and posted photos on Instagram of the welcome basket full of local fruits, cookies, and candies that was waiting for him in his room. Perhaps hiding was what people instinctively did when they felt threatened, even if it made no logical sense. He'd have to ask the human nature expert about that, too.
No, of course not, he said. That would be stupid. Where did you park the car?
In the hotel garage. I figured we'd walk to the bookstore. It's only a few blocks away.
Good thinking. Rental cars are equipped with GPS transponders, so they can be constantly tracked by the rental companies. That was a cool fact he'd picked up while researching one of his Clint Straker books. Now, it might help save him in real life.
That's nice to know, Margot said. But I think I'll remember where I parked without having to call Hertz for help.
Ian looked around, trying to decide where to go next. The Sheraton was on a hill. He could go uphill on Pike Street, east toward the freeway in Lake Washington, or head downhill, west toward the I-35